I'm Stephen Downs.
And I'm Adam Rizvi.
And this is Letters to the Sky, a podcast about the metaphysical iconoclasts, philosophical visionaries, and religious leaders of the world.
Whether you consider yourself religious, spiritual, neither, or something in between, we invite you to take a deep dive with us down metaphysical rabbit holes and learn to see your life from a new perspective.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, Stephen.
How the heck are you? Oh, and I just want to acknowledge, thank you for not using my last name.
I was about to say.
Do you want to restart? Hey, Adam.
I consciously chose not to use your last name, just so that listeners can realize I, too, am making progress.
It's an illusion, but okay. Not really. All right. Not too bad. We're getting into a rhythm now with these episodes, and we have, I think, we can both agree, going to be a very powerful one today. And this one is on a book titled Proof of Heaven by a neurosurgeon named Eben Alexander. And Adam, would you like to tell us a little bit of a background? I mean, I can jump in too, but why don't you?
Yeah, thank you.
You want to say anything else at first?
Eben Alexander, M.D., although I think these days he recognizes that those extra two letters are not as important as maybe he initially thought on the beginning of his journey.
Speaking from experience?
Yes. Yeah, they are overrated letters, but they help. So this is a physician, specifically a neurosurgeon, who goes from living a pretty impressive on paper, at least, life of accomplishments and as a medical professional, as a neurosurgeon, you know, published peer-reviewed literature, chapters of textbooks, helping many patients, doing complex neurosurgical procedures, and living very much in a materialistic mindset that, you know, this physical world is all that exists. And as he's bound to go into later on, that consciousness is a byproduct of the brain and the brain's mechanisms. And so he lived that life only to have a pretty astounding near-death experience for, I mean, there's so many near-death stories out there, but he has a pretty amazing one for the purpose of the scientific community. And we can get into why that was such a helpful experience for him and for the scientific community. And then he talks a little bit about the effects for him as well as for his family and all his readers of his near-death experience and the ramifications, the consequences, the potential benefit to society as a whole. It's a really good, I think, exposure to the near-death phenomenon.
I think it's a great one. Absolutely, especially for people from a Judeo-Christian background, for sure. I mean, just the language he's using is Judeo-Christian, but it is great. And I actually recognized a lot of things from like the Tibetan Book of the Dead in there. So some similarities we can get into, but, do you want to, I think that was a good introduction. Do you mind if I dive a little bit into the background?
Yeah, please. All right. Dive or so, gently step into the waters.
I'm going to sink slowly. Okay. So this beloved doctor came down with a sudden illness. And it's funny because, Adam, you actually might not necessarily deal with this specific illness a lot, but he ends up in your world. And I know you as a neurocritical care doctor work with neurosurgeons a lot. And so I am really interested to hear your take on this. But he ends up with bacterial meningitis, which he mentions repeatedly is a disease that is usually only found in infants and people that have had recent neurosurgery where the blood-brain barrier has been compromised surgically. And for those who don't know, and I'm just going to play doctor here, the blood-brain barrier is a sort of protection against the rest of your body that protects your spinal cord and your brain. And it's so most things do not pass that. And so it's a pretty safe space. And what happens when you get sick there is that something has bypassed it. And so that's why it usually happens, I'm guessing, in infants with poor defense immune systems, and then people who've had neurosurgery where that has literally been cut open. and compromise. Is that a fair summation?
Dr. Downs, well done.
I just read the book, man. So it's very rare, and he goes into often, and can you confirm this, Dr. Rizvi, how rare this would be to happen spontaneously in an adult male in his 50s or whatever?
Yeah, they actually said 1 in 10 million,
yeah,
I think were the odds, and specifically it's E. coli. It's not that bacterial meningitis itself is that rare, but it's that particular form.
E. coli, okay, got it, thank you.
It's so, found in your poop.
Yeah, E. coli is everywhere, man.
Yeah,
that's what they used to study, like, everything. It's just a nice version of E. coli and not the mean one. this is a good little primer on molecular biology for those who are interested. So, he gets sick, and then he ends up – his brain shuts down, his neocortex, which is – the way he describes it is the top layer of your brain – is basically what makes you human, and it's all the different functionality that kind of makes a human human and not another kind of lower life form, for lack of a better word. And a lot of the times when people have what's unique about one of the unique things about his experience from a medical perspective, at least the way he tells it, is that a lot of the things like hallucinations, things like visualizations, things like tripping, right? Like psychedelics, they happen in the prefrontal cortex or the neocortex. And so for that to be shut down and then for him to have this experience is medically impossible. And that was one of the kind of, I guess, arguments he uses why this is not just like some trip he was on. And he goes in the end of the book and kind of talks about kind of him checking over, like, what could this possibly be explained by? And there's no medical explanation or physical explanation for how someone with this low a brain function have these experiences, which are similar to what to a lot of other near-death experiences.
You know, what's interesting is when I'm in the ICU, I often have to deal with patients who have pretty severe brain injury, and both infections, but also more often it's after a cardiac arrest, after someone has a heart attack, there's lack of, for that brief period of time where the heart's not working, there's lack of blood flow to the brain. And so the brain shuts down, and the portions of the brain that tend to be the most affected are the very outermost portions, which is the neocortex. And it's so funny because I've found myself saying to family members, you know, the part that makes him or her, your loved one, a human and a personality as you know it, is the part that's been damaged. So language, speech, the ability to understand one another, memories, personality, the ability to focus, plan ahead, recognize faces, all of these things, they all live in the neocortex. And I found in rereading this that it's such a built-in part of neurology and medical science to equate selfhood with the neocortex. So it's true. It's very, very true. And that's what makes this so amazing, is that is specifically the part of his brain that was, at the time, irreversibly damaged. Those were some of the words that the doctors that were taking care of him used.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this, so we've been describing it from a medical perspective, just to give some, I think, some background context into what is happening to this man, who's a neurosurgeon. But I want to get into, one, his experiences while he was having his near-death experience. And then I also want to talk a little bit about the hard problem of consciousness, because he does touch on it a decent amount in this book, but I think it's just a good conversation that we have and we keep having in terms of whether the brain is producing consciousness or whether it's more of an interface for consciousness that is not tied to the body. So does that sound good to you, dear
friend?
It
sounds really good. And one of the things I like about the episodes that we do is it gives people a chance to vicariously read the book through us. So let's
take still them. Read the book through. It's an easy read. It's a short read. You should also read the book.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Why don't you tell us, Stephen, what did he experience?
It was interesting. So when he first kind of goes under, for lack of a better word, he describes it as like earthworm view, where he is like black with some like veins crawling around, and it's uncomfortable, and there's like tension, and he described like smells of like human waste and kind of these really intense experiences that he was perceiving as negative.
Yeah.
And then it slowly opened up, and then he went through that kind of this darkness. He went through this darkness, and then he saw a light that kind of started. He went up the tube of light, is what he described, which I thought was a very after classic. Just doing on becoming an alchemist. She literally talks about going up. How does she go up the vertical, as she calls it? Is
yeah, good point.
And so he goes in. Yeah, I was seeing some tie-ins there. He travels through or up this light, whatever direction you want to call it. And then he ends up in kind of this paradise, for lack of a better word, this heaven. And in this heaven, just it's so funny, all the parallels to becoming an alchemist. He's talking about how he's able to understand concepts that are far beyond what his brain can comprehend in just an instant. It's like this levels of other dimensions, of other realities, of other universes, of the role that good and evil play in our lives taking shape, and the role of free will, that he experiences all of these truths of who we really are. And then he eventually comes back. But I want to touch on what he stressed over and over, kind of his three big takeaways when he was there. Were you are loved and cherished. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. And he describes that over quite a few times, not over and over again, but several times throughout the book. There's this importance of this, and I found that to be a central part of his experience, which I was telling you before we had this call was. Well, I don't want to go too far ahead, but I do want to talk about the difference between this kind of an experience and the kind of experiences that you and I have had actually perfectly alive and not almost dead.
Yeah.
and that a lot of meditators and spiritual practitioners have had, and how similar they are to this, and how unique it is that we really like it when it comes from a near-death experience, but I could have told you these things just from my own experiences meditating. Now, yeah. Not that, you know, it doesn't devalue one or the other, but it's just really interesting, the fascination with near-death experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. We may not need to dive into that too much, but you just nailed it. I mean, you just said it. If for those interested in this material, you need not die to have access to this truth. And he even talks about that to the very, very end. You don't need to die. Just begin the work right here, right now. Prayer and meditation. Go within. Go deep down in yourself, and you start to recognize that wisdom and that truth is inside of you. And this, you'll start to have experiences that speak to the sense that you are loved and you can do no wrong. But why don't you continue a little bit further? So he had this earthworm's view.
That's what he called it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what he called it.
Which is this darkness sort of this dark, and kind of muddy.
Muddy, yeah. Thick. Like I imagine it being like as if he was the earthworm in the dirt, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then he came out of it, tunnel of light. And speak a little bit to the gateway and the butterfly.
I'm actually kind of. I think you should say that one because that didn't stick out in my mind as a memory.
Oh, well, just that when he gets out of the tunnel of light, I mean, you could call that a gateway of sorts. He ends up in a beautiful land of, you know, bright colors, super vivid, rolling hills, and he finds himself riding on the wings of a giant butterfly. And alongside of him is a beautiful woman, you know, I think she had blue eyes. I can't recall.
You said high cheekbones and blue eyes.
High cheekbones and blue eyes, yes. Yeah, and it's, you had a funny comment off right before we started recording about...
So Aryan.
Yeah, but I think, again, a brief comment to the fact that when Buddhists die, they see Buddha. When Christians die, they see Jesus. You know, like, we do need to talk a little bit about the filters that we experience reality through. And it's not like those filters stop being present when you die, because the filters are inherent to the mind itself. But so he's on the butterfly. He experiences like this synesthesia where all the colors are felt, and he can hear the music of the spheres, and it's amazing. And eventually he goes to this place of being in the void. It's darkness, but it's not negative. He says he feels the immeasurable love of God, and he merges with it as this deep oneness, and it's almost like his sense of self begins to dissolve, and all he knows is love and the love of God for him. And I found that really profound. One, because usually people associate that with a brilliant white light, and you dissolve into the white light, whereas he's saying it's a darkness. And I kind of like that, because it tells you it doesn't really matter how it's showing up in terms of the colors, but what the key takeaway is, he felt loved, and it was unconditional, and it just touched me. I've come across so many of these stories, but every time someone describes it, it's always so heartfelt and genuinely expressed that you feel that love as well a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, going back to the first kind of truth that he realized, that you are loved, this is something that's stuck with me since the very first time I got seriously involved in like meditation. One of the reasons why I stuck with it was one of the first experiences I had was an experience of intense unconditional love, of being loved. And it was this completely wholesome healing experience where nothing was wrong anymore. And just like he says, you know, like, you can do no wrong. And what that left me with was kind of this knowledge that he talks about, like, love is the basis of reality, right? He talks, and that's a very, like, doesn't mean a lot in words, because there's so many meanings with reality and with love, and which kind of love and which kind of reality and all that. But I was, you know, I think I've experienced something like that, where when you remove the problem, when you remove the feeling of lack, when you remove the suffering, what's left is a natural lovingness, and that is the foundation of everything. And when you experience some sort of profound transcendental truth, it often has that quality baked into it. Like, that is the fundamental quality of reality itself, is this freedom from suffering, this unconditional lovingness. And so I really found that powerful. It really, it really touched me and reminded me of those moments in my life when that's been super present. And so I think that was a huge takeaway for me, is just, you know, just how much is available when we feel loved.
Yeah. Yeah, so much of the suffering that occurs in our life occurs because we're calling out for that love. But we don't know how to do that, and so it shows up as attack and anger, resentment, judgment, fear, despair even, right? There's so many ways that call for love will show. And it's been said many times that all forms of expression are either expressions of love or calls for love.
I love that. Yeah, I love that.
It's a good way of looking at it. Do you remember what happened to him next?
After the darkness?
No, yeah, like after his whole journey in the afterlife, and then coming back and all the tidbits he reintegrated.
Yeah, he had some really... So, I mean, I didn't know about ICU psychosis. So basically, he came back... So he had this... And the book kind of goes back and forth between what was happening here in the physical reality with his family, worrying about him, his condition worsening, things like that. And then it goes back to the experiences he was having that were transcendental and, you know, all the things that he was learning. And it's clear that he was able to convey very little of that in this book. It was just too profound, which is fair. And so when he comes back, they're going to say, you know, okay, I think we need to talk about taking him off his antibiotics, aka letting him die. Mm-hmm. And it apparently has been raining this whole time, like just really crappy, complete cloud cover weather this entire time. And then there's someone involved who is kind of a medium and is saying, like, he's not dead. He will come back. Just you have to give him time. And his son, his young son, kind of is also on that that page of, like, I know you're in there, and he's coming back. And then the son, you know, from what he reports he has, that morning that he ended up coming back into consciousness, or awake consciousness, the sun broke and there was a beautiful rainbow. And then he like opened his eyes and said, what was it? Not everything is all right, but it was something, the equivalent of that, of everything's all right. And, you know, it's this miracle, because this does not happen. You know, when someone has had damage to their prefrontal or their neocortex for that long, under those conditions and that infection, they do not come back. They are a vegetable for the rest of their lives. It's usually short at that point.
Yeah, the infectious disease doctor who actually wrote an appendix, Dr. Scott Wade, was having conversations with the family saying, listen, you have to be prepared. Even if he survives, he's going to have such significant cognitive impairment. He won't be the person you remember. So he was emotionally preparing them for that.
Yeah. And so he comes back, and then I did not know about this thing called ICU psychosis, but apparently when you come back from a coma or from some intense sort of traumatic experience, is it just with comas, Adam?
All is well, he said.
All is well. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All is well. Okay. And then don't worry. All is well.
Okay. Thank you for finding that. So is ICU psychosis something that happens in comas, or what situations do you see it in?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's different terms for it. We can call it ICU delirium, ICU psychosis. There's now found to be hypoactive and hyperactive ICU delirium. Some people, you know, they get delirious. They don't know where they are. They have fluctuations in their consciousness, meaning they're alert, and then sometimes they're not alert. They'll confuse people. They'll feel like paranoia, like that people are trying to kill them or attack them.
And just to jump in real quick, so in the ICU, most of your patients and most of ICU patients are unconscious and intubated. And we're talking now about when a patient regains consciousness after whatever disease process they have going on is resolving. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I will say that's not – I don't think ICU delirium is a product necessarily of the underlying disease process, because I see it in all sorts of patients.
No, but it happens when they're coming out of it, basically. However it's happening.
Yeah, I think it's just the fact that they're in the ICU. The loss of the day-night cycles, all the medications running through them, the inflammatory mediators, like all these cytokines floating around in their body. Even if they've never lost consciousness, if you're in the ICU long enough, you will go a little crazy. And we use the term delirious. Because you're not like, it's not a psychiatric condition in the sense that it's permanent. It's absolutely related to the fact that you're in the ICU. And oftentimes I'll tell, when I talk to family members about, okay, why they're, you know, they're worried, they're asking, why is my dad so crazy? You know, I tell them, listen, he's in the ICU. It's very confusing. There's noise all the time. He doesn't know what day it is. If we can get him out of the ICU, see the sunlight and sunshine, feel some fresh air on his skin, he will improve.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So he comes out of it, and then he has this recovery period where he's going through this delirium, and he describes his own paranoia, and he only trusts two people, and, you know, it's kind of intense for his family to watch and everything. And then he eventually comes back, and I do, if we have time, talk about this, how he describes several moments when his neural like neuroscientific knowledge came back to him in kind of chunks, where he would have a hard time. I remember him talking about afterwards he was trying to help one of his college-aged son write a paper for his neuroscience class, and he just couldn't come up with the concepts that he knew, but he didn't know them now. And he said it took him about 2 months for that knowledge to come back to him fully, which I thought was fascinating, and I wanted to talk about if we get a chance in terms of where knowledge is stored, where memory is stored, and what about experiences where people learn languages spontaneously or things like that, where there's no actual reason. Anyway, it made me think of like where knowledge is stored and how we can access it. But then he comes back and he basically, at the advice of this same college-age son, writes down everything that happened to him before he starts researching other near-death experiences or talking to other people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he writes it all down and then he starts researching it. And he finds a lot of similarities, and he kind of discovers that while there are a lot of similarities between other near-death experiences and his is unique in that he really lost sense of self. He lost his sense of earthly self anyway. Mm-hmm. He did not remember who he was or how he got there, which apparently with a lot of near-death experiencers, they even when they're in other realms, they are still firmly tied to their identity as a human. And he kind of theorizes in the book that that's one of the reasons why he was able to see so many higher realms is because he had completely left that chain behind for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
And so he basically comes back and he kind of realizes like, look, like this could have happened to anybody, but it happened to me, a neurosurgeon who happens to know all about the brain. And mm-hmm. what kind of this, you know, this is, what's happening and how this couldn't have happened to somebody under these circumstances with no neocortex function.
Neocortex
function. And that he kind of comes up with, you know, it's his job to share this news that we're loved, that nothing's wrong, that, you know, there's a plan and some sort of like divine, like pre-described plan, but like that we're okay, you know, that we're having an experience as spiritual beings and that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with us. And so he finds that this book was, it's been quite a few years now since this experience, he had this experience, and he mentions that this book was written about 3 years after. So, I'm curious to see how his kind of mission has changed since then. But he talks about how, you know, a lot of his colleagues and medical colleagues, they have no explanation for how he was able to survive or how he was able to have these experiences, but they still can't come to grips with what happened and mm-hmm. kind of say, oh, yeah, you know, crazy things happen when people are in comas.
Yeah.
Like that's, even though it's a medical impossibility, what happened. And, you know, and then he talks about the hard problem of consciousness. And so that's kind of how the book wraps up.
Yeah, that's a great – I think that's a good segue into actually discussing it.
Let's talk about it.
Last or second to last chapter. I forget. So it's one of the very last chapters where he calls it the enigma of consciousness. So, well, for the sake of repeating ourselves, again, I do think it's worthwhile because it's so – surprising to me that we're still having this conversation.
But it is really surprising.
Yeah, but I think it just needs to be had repeatedly so that people are aware of the full situation. So the hard problem of consciousness, I think he states it. There's like three components to it. I'm not going to do it justice.
I'll find them
look for it. It's in that chapter, Enigma of Consciousness. But essentially, the question is, how does the brain produce consciousness? How does the consciousness that it produces lead to the behavior that we have? And then how? Is it something related to the emotions?
How does the perceived world relate to the real world? You nailed those first two.
So. Nice. How does the perceived world relate to the real world? So I think there's a couple of funny aspects to those questions, especially the first one. How does the brain produce consciousness? It's a question based on a false premise, as far as I'm concerned. Because the alternative to the materialist reductionist perspective of reality, which is to say the only thing that exists is the physical. Anything that's not measurable objectively doesn't exist. That's what a reductionist materialist would say. The alternative to that, or one among many alternatives, is that consciousness exists independent of the body, that the foundational construct of reality isn't the physical, but rather consciousness itself. That comes first. That exists a priori to anything physical. And if one were to take that as the premise, then, in Eben Alexander goes on to say, then all sorts of previously unexplained things like the placebo effect, telepathy, remote viewing, when you're able to predict the future, all those experiences, all those abilities are explained by the fact that consciousness is fundamental and the physical is secondary. So that is currently the problem. It's funny, the hard problem of consciousness. But really, he goes on to say the data, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. I have been really direct with many of my scientific colleagues who are open to having this conversation with me, that the data are irrefutable. They are so overwhelmingly in the favor of the point of view that consciousness is fundamental to reality, that mind is fundamental. There's another way of putting it. The universe is mental, or the universe is mind, right? That's another way of talking about this. And that physicality is secondary. Now, well, I'll just put it there. There is one other thing that I want to say, because I think he took it one step forward, and it's a very necessary step forward, which is to say, hey, you know, consciousness is not a byproduct. It is the foundation. I think there's a room for a conversation to be had of not seeing a dichotomy between consciousness and the physical, but understanding that it's all consciousness. That which we call physical itself is an expression of consciousness. It's projections of the mind. And that's a whole other conversation to have. But I'm just sharing that for those of you who are listening. You know, this is an introductory book in many ways. There's a huge rabbit hole to dive into when you really get to explore this question, the hard problem of consciousness.
Well, I think that gets to the third point in the hard problem of consciousness, and which we can talk about for a second, is how does the perceived world relate to the real world? And so this is where my mind goes with it, and I kind of tie it to a form of Buddhist philosophy, just because that's what I'm more familiar with, where it kind of says that, you know, the bare minimum you actually can't have any sort of knowledge of what is real and what isn't. The only thing you can do is know your relationship to it. So it's not about what is real, what is out there, which is, I mean, even if you look at, I feel like we have had this conversation so many times on this podcast, and just you and I in general, like, if you look at how science, the scientific method came to be, it came to be with these certain, like, agreed upon, like, premises, like even physics, like you can't measure anything in physics. Physics doesn't exist unless you have an X and a Y axis, unless you have a relationship between two things. Like, and we all just agree that it's called this, you know, we all just agree on these terms and they're shared, and there's all sorts of assumptions that go into it. But, you know, at the fundamental level, I suppose.
Yeah, just a brief jump in here. There are places in the world that everything is relational. So, like, for weights and measures, there's somewhere in England, I think, where there's a piece of metal that weighs 1 kilo, and everyone in the world agrees on the fact that piece of stone is the definition of 1 kilogram, and then everything else.
And hasn't it changed over time?
I don't know. Has it? Well, I guess I believe
it's gotten lighter or something like that.
So that, what does that say about all the measurements of everything?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that's your point. It's all relational. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all relational. And I don't want to get stuck on that too much because that gets too heady too quick. But, you know, really coming back to, okay, like, I mean, even like Western empiricism, okay, fine. What can I actually say? Can I actually tell you that what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing is actually there? Like you can't prove it. You just can't.
Yeah.
And so what do we have control over? At the fundamental level, we have, as beings, we have control over our relationship to it. And it's a bit more passive, you know, because like he talks about the placebo effect, which is literally your brain affecting reality. Like the fact that the placebo effect exists and isn't like the most studied phenomenon in the history of science blows my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can all get into a little conspiracy as to why that is, as in there's not a lot of money to be made in figuring out how to utilize the placebo effect.
The placebo effect is free, so it's not patentable.
Yeah, exactly. 30%, you know, 30% of the time when someone's given a fake drug, they have the real effect or some crazy, you know, it's significant. It's extremely significant. And what does that say? Like, I mean, these aren't like, their cold went away. It's like they got a cancer drug and the cancer went away. It's wild. So what is our, I mean, that's one aspect of, okay, mind over matter, like it's literally like you're saying, that's there's so much evidence for it. It's not even like, it's crazy that we're still having this conversation.
Oh, and for those who don't want to take our word for it, and that's I respect
you should.
That.
You no, I don't. You should only listen to us.
Steven, remember we are experts at being non-experts. I think we agreed on that. Eben Alexander recommends we read The Irreducible Mind,
which I have not read. I didn't know about that book.
Who the author's by. I'll look that up here and share with you. The Irreducible Mind. And then I'll also add a book to the recommendation, The End to Upside Down Thinking by Mark Gober. I would say those two books, if you read, apparently The Irreducible Mind was written as a collaborative effort by the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. They took a very scientific approach and amassed all the information, data, studies beyond just anecdotes that support the fact that consciousness exists independent of the physical body and does in fact continue after the body's death.
Hmm. Okay. I'll have to read that one. I do want to read that one. So there's the issue of mind over matter, that, you know, consciousness exists outside of the body, but then there's the fundamental like knowledge of like, what do we actually control? We don't control what's real outside of us. Again, we can argue whether there is or isn't. I think that's fair. And I think ultimately there is not, but, what do we have to say about it? What we have to say is our relationship to it. So these things are presented to me. This is the situation I'm in. This is what my eyes see. This is what my ears hear. This is what my nose smells. This is what my fingers touch. What is my relationship to that thing? That's the only thing that you fundamentally have any say over. I think that's a pretty powerful realization that, you know, just coming to just not knowing, like, I just keep coming back to these darn Zen folk with their don't know mind, but it's really powerful.
Yeah. Well, I think for many people, you can't tell them enough that death is not the end. It's such a deep-seated fear. It's a human fear. I think it's a universal fear. It's a primordial fear that it will be all over when we die, and it will have all been for naught. And when someone hears that when you die, it's not the end, that the loved ones you've lost are there to meet you on the other side, that this sense of belonging, of being loved, is real, and it's the fundamental truth of reality. We've built such walls against that love, that when something like this book comes around and a portion of that wall crumbles and falls and lets that radiant light shining in to warm our hearts, it's a welcome experience. And I've known many people who have read this book and said it touched them in a pretty profound way. I personally love going on YouTube and hearing people talk about near-death experiences. I love it. And every time I'm having a terrible day, anyone listening to this, I recommend just go on YouTube. In fact, I'll recommend a specific channel. Type in near-death experience, listen to what people have to say, and it will brighten your day because it brings meaning back into our lives. It brings love back into our lives. And the other thing that it does for me is it very appropriately puts things in perspective, which sometimes we get so caught up in the little details. Here are the two shows that I'll recommend. A shout out to Next Level Soul Podcast, a fantastic interviewer. I can't recall his name. I think his name is Ferry something. I'm so sorry, buddy, if you're listening to this. But Next Level Soul Podcast, he also has a YouTube channel. And then Shaman Oaks is another one. I look at or listen to the near-death experiences from both of those channels. It always makes my day.
Yeah, so I think there's something special about near-death experiences. It does fulfill a need that we seem to have, this fear that we're alone, that there's an end, that we're small, that there's no meaning. Yet, like you're saying, there's no meaning. And it's so interesting because not only does the near-death experience itself speak to the fact that it exists, speak to the fact that we're not alone. You could just have a near-death experience and then it could be something terrible. Mm-hmm. But it's like often, like even Alexander is describing, there is a complete wholeness and the lack of anything being wrong and this deep connection. Like you were speaking earlier, I forget the word you used, and he used it in the book and it's not coming to me, where everything is contained within everything. So when you hear a sound, you're hearing everything contained in that sound. When you're seeing something, you're seeing all of the universe refracted in that one thing appearing before you. And there's this this holographic connection that every experience has. And that, you know, when we leave here, that is what we return to. You know, and that there are guides, there are beings and, you know, other consciousnesses that are here to help us if we need them, to guide us and to let us know that it's not. So this is what we're going to end up getting to, the power of relating to these guides, and whether they're, you know, we can talk about spirit guides, we can talk about guardian angels, we can talk about physical guides like teachers who are, you know, because like I was saying earlier, these same truths have been taught for thousands and thousands and thousands of years by spiritual masters. And they've said the exact same thing and people have experienced the exact same thing here. But there's something, you know, when someone comes back from a death and says, hey, by the way, it's all good. You don't have to worry about it. Like, you know, there's something special about that.
Yeah, very special. I want to point out the fact that while this is clearly an experience that he's having through Judeo-Christian lenses, right? It's not traditional, I would say, dogmatic Christianity, in the sense that he comes back and he says, hey, everything is okay for those that believe. Everyone right. else yeah. will go to hell.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
like that.
True. Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
Although he does talk very briefly about good and evil, the biggest overwhelming message he's offering is that everyone is loved. And at the core of our being, we are all innocent. No one has done anything wrong. Now, that's if you really look at that, we don't live that way. We don't operate our lives as if those things were true. We definitely want some people to be wrong and others right, and we are typically in the right camp, and the some person du jour that we are upset at is in the wrong camp. He's saying everyone is loved, and that innocence is present everywhere. I think that really needs to be heard on a very, very deep level, because if I go around my life as I, this is a huge practice of mine, is seeing the innocence in my brother, seeing that they too are loved by Source. They're not judged. They're accepted wholly and completely as they are. If I can treat the people around me that way, that on a deep unconscious level, I'm treating myself that way. And what tends to happen is these blocks to love start to fall away. I feel like it's so important for people to hear that. That's also why books like this are so, so powerful, and why they resonate so much is because we all know this is true on a very deep level of our being. We all know that love is, you know, love is at the core. It's at the root of all existence. I feel like for however intellectual our conversations get, you and I, one thing we tend to always come back to and we always agree on is love and the importance of love. Wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, what you're saying now is, yeah, we talk about this all the time. We come back to this. It's kind of fundamental truth, you know. And another, one of the practices that I like, you know, you said seeing the innocence of my brother. And I think for me, when I'm in those intense moments or when I'm judging someone or feel upset, like realizing that if I'm whole and there's nothing wrong with me, then there's nothing to defend against. There's nothing to protect. Because so many of my like judgments and reactions are me trying to protect myself, like you said earlier, were either they're either acts of love or acts of trying to earn love. Mm-hmm. And you know, if I can see myself as whole and understand my fundamental wholeness, then when someone else does something that is quote unquote bad to me, it literally goes through me. Like there's nowhere for it to stick. There's nowhere for it to gain purchase. And all that remains is still that love, because like, okay, you said something bad about me, but like, I know if I have this knowing and experience of myself as whole, then what they're saying doesn't hold any weight.
Yeah.
Because
in fact,
I know it's just words.
It's just words. And it becomes so evident that it's coming from a place of hurt on their end.
Yeah, it makes me love them more.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, my sense of love grows because I see what they need, right? That they need to feel loved, and that this is possible for them.
It's great because then it simplifies a lot of life. If all of life is either an expression of love or a call for love, then you ask yourself, okay, well, what's the appropriate response to both of those things? If someone expresses love to you, you express love back. If someone calls for love to you, you mm-hmm. express love back to them.
Yeah,
and it does very much simplify life. And I notice that I do that to myself when I make a quote-unquote mistake, when I say something I really probably shouldn't have, and I acted out of anger or jealousy or spite, then I start to beat up myself for that internally, you know, and then I realize, oh, that feeling of guilt in me is a call for love, because really all I want is for myself to love myself. Does that make sense? Like you can actually have that same dynamic, but inside, internally.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This reminds me of, so the teacher Osho, who is an absolute madman and there's no end to the controversy of this man, but I've watched quite a number of the videos of his talks. And someone asked him why he never talked about love, why he never talked about like being more loving. And I thought his answer was really profound. And he said, I don't talk about it because if you just get rid of the other stuff, that's what emerges. You don't need to try and be more loving. You just have to work on the stuff that isn't, and that will emerge naturally as your natural state. And I've found that to be so true. Like, when there's nothing wrong, what emerges is this, like I said at the beginning, this natural loving state. That's just this gentle, unconditional love.
Yeah, I have heard and come across many different quotes around that particular idea. Remember, we talked about this idea of spirituality being building upon things and gaining knowledge, or a spirituality that removes and removes until it exposes the core of truth, in this case, love. I've heard it said that essentially the spiritual journey is the removal of the blocks to the awareness of love's presence. I think it's a great way of putting it. I also pulled up one of my favorite quotes from Osho, since you brought up Osho. I also like him too for his iconoclastic qualities. This is not directly related to what we're talking about, but it's just a favorite quote of mine.
Osho, sure, why not? Let's do it.
He's talking about democracy. He says, and there's a YouTube clip on this, which I recommend. He says, democracy is not the highest goal. It is not the end of the journey, because democracy basically means government by the people, of the people, for the people, but the people are retarded. It's so good. It's terrible and at the same time, but you know, that's Osho. What can you do?
That's so true. That's peak Osho.
Peak Osho.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is kind of book. It made me want to know more about Ibn Alexander's teachings post experience that he had, because this book just felt like it scratched the bare surface, mm-hmm. Of this experience and what was possible in these deeper truths. And I'm saying that as someone, you know, has been, I'm almost 40 now, and I've been steeped in this world since I was 18. So, like, I do have quite a bit of background exposure to these ideas. And, but it made me curious. It reignited my curiosity of, you know, this kind of other side of things.
He actually has two other books.
I bet he does.
Yeah, I think the most recent one is Living in a Mindful Universe. It might be worth us doing, maybe to close out the discussion of Ibn Alexander and what his message is. I will say one of the biggest takeaways from this book, and this will be maybe my last comment on Proof of Heaven, is that you can be inspired by someone else's near-death experience, but you don't need to wait for your own near-death or death experience. And nor is that the point of it all. It is to go within yourself. And he himself says, begin a practice. Start praying. Start meditating. Go within. As we talked about, I truly believe that these lessons, these truths that he talks about, are readily accessible all the time. And so if you're listening to this and you've made it far into this episode, invite yourself, ask yourself, can I spend 5 minutes tonight, this evening, right before bed, just closing my eyes, going within, and becoming aware of the depth of my own being and the wisdom that's there? Do you have a takeaway, good sir, for this book?
I don't know how I'm supposed to top that one.
You don't have to top it. You can bottom it.
No, I do. This is a, you and I are strictly competitive.
It's all competition. Huh?
Our friendship is alive only because we're competitive with another. No, my takeaway from this. Yeah, I mean, I really, that is one of the things that stuck out to me, was that you do not have to wait for death to have this kind of experience. I mean, really, you don't. Like, these truths, these knowings, this information, it is completely available right now if you turn within. I mean, completely available, and more. You know, he scratches the surface, and he talks about the amount of knowledge and the amount of understandings he was granted or that he experienced, and that, you know, I know from having my own experiences like that, that you can't put it into words, you can't write it down in a book, and it's something that you have to experience and to know it. And so it is completely available right now in every moment, and that you are completely whole and perfect, and there's not a single thing wrong with you, nor has there ever been, nor could there ever be, and that you are absolutely God. You are 100% perfect.
Wow.
Not even a question of a shadow of a doubt.
Not a shadow of a doubt. That's a great way to end that, and a great truth to wrap up on.
Wonderful. All right. Well, that went somewhere I didn't quite expect, but I'm glad it did.
Yeah. Yeah. My memory of this book will always be riding on the wings of a blue butterfly and feeling that I'm loved. I think it's a great takeaway, and a great contribution that Dr. Alexander has offered the world.
Wonderful. Well, then I think we'll wrap her up.
As a reminder, Stephen and I have been really working hard at making these episodes more practical, immensely more applicable to our lives, finding ways to apply what we read about to our daily life. We have a newsletter that will go into this material deeply, tells you what we're doing and when. Please go on to our website, letterstothesky.com, sign up for our newsletter, be a part of the community, of the group. We also will be doing YouTube lives and possibly Instagram lives as well. We had an Instagram live. We want to do YouTubes as well, so we're going to do both every month, where we will recap and do more of a off-the-cuff discussion of the book that we just covered. And I think there's the topic of near-death experiences is so rich, it's so huge, that to even do one live after this may not be enough.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Well said.
I stole your thunder, huh? That's usually your thing.
I'm really glad you did it. That's perfect. I'm just like melting after that episode and reminding myself of those beautiful truths. So it's kind of a puddle right now. So I appreciate you taking that one.
Good, good. I'll sweep you up. Don't worry.
You sweep puddles? All right.
Yeah. Well, you don't. All right.
I'll vacuum it up with a hot vac.
With a wet vac, yeah.
There you go. All right. Thank you, Adam.
You're welcome.
All right, my friend. Well, until next time, I hope you're well.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.